to reach a point. I listened to Netanyahu recently speaking in Hebrew to his clan, to his group, Ben-Gvir, Smotrich, and others like that. And at the end of his remarks in Hebrew, which was translated for me very reliably, I think, he essentially said that if it went south, if it went bad, he was prepared to show the Iranians something they had never seen before. I think he meant a nuclear weapon. And I go back to 1973 when Golda Meir told a BBC reporter, you can check, it was printed in London the next day on the front page, that she would use a nuclear weapon in response to his question, would you use a nuclear weapon? Because at that time, they were pretty hard-pressed in the 73 war. And she said, yes, without equivocation. I think we're back at that point again, and for probably a far more dangerous situation.
I know you have to go, Colonel Wilkerson, but I just want to point out you were the former chief of staff of Secretary of State Colin Powell, who dragged his feet on supporting the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, but ultimately gave that speech that he would call a stain on his career at the U.N. It was critical for Bush, President Bush, that it was Colin Powell who gave the speech because he was seen as the reluctant warrior. And he gave that speech saying there was evidence of Saddam Hussein having weapons of mass destruction. Can you make a parallel to what we're seeing today?
I can, but I think this is far greater a travesty and a tragedy. That was bad enough, and torture was the thing that broke my back, and ultimately it sort of broke Colin Powell's back, too, because we realized that we had signed up not only to a war that was not necessary, we had signed up to a president of the United States for the first time in the nation's history making public policy torture. Other human beings being tortured was made presidential public policy. This is far worse, I think, and it's been building for some time. It's been building all since Trump was elected and actually since his first administration. And I think it makes what we did, not to discount it, but it makes it pale by comparison, and it makes me deeply concerned about the future of this republic.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Lawrence Wilkerson, retired Army colonel, former chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell from 2002 to 2005. Coming up, we look at how the Gulf nations are responding to the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran and the conflicting statements President Trump makes throughout the day. Then we talk about wars for oil with Antonia Yuhas. Stay with us.
Mass killings and mass graves, globalization of slaves, genocide and extinction, all the functions of civilization. Mass killings and mass graves, globalization of slaves, genocide and extinction, all the functions of civilization.
You know that the war will never be over, cause war is our bread and butter. We've been living a lie that there's no place or any other. Living creature that doesn't think like you and me. Yes, now we're getting to the root of the Taker story.
The Taker Story by Chicano Batman, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue our coverage of the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran, we turn now to look at how Gulf nations are responding. Earlier today, Iran reportedly fired drones towards Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and United Arab Emirates, where a large fire broke out in an industrial area home to petrochemical plants. A suspected Iranian missile also hit a residential building in the capital of Bahrain, killing one person and injuring eight others. We go now to Karim Shaheen, Middle East editor for New Lines magazine. His recent piece is headlined, "The Gulf Fears Whoever Wins This War." He grew up in Dubai, joining us now from Montreal. Why don't you explain that headline, "The Gulf Fears Whoever Wins This War," Kadeem?
Thank you for having me, first of all. I think whether, if we're looking at the different scenarios of how this war ends, first of all, we can see a scenario where the Iranian regime survives in the guise of Mujtaba Khamenei, the son of the former Ayatollah, which will persist in its policies towards the Gulf. Only now it realizes that it can sway American policy, that it can expand its target list in the Gulf from what everyone expected it to be, which was American military bases, to various economic assets, to various diplomatic assets, embassies, consulates, to energy infrastructure, to desalination plants, to the broader way of life in the Gulf that has, for the past few decades, tried to market itself as this haven for people from the region and for expatriates from the West to come and work and do business and live their life in isolation, almost in a silo from all the instability and chaos that's been going on in the Middle East for the past few years and for the past few decades, and where you can be peaceful and multicultural societies. And that's what Iran ultimately targeted through its extensive barrages and missiles and drone strikes that have taken place all across the Gulf. Only now it's going to be this glowering Iran that has managed to survive this American and Israeli onslaught, knows that it can target all of these different assets belonging to the Gulf and not really face any major consequences and be able to sway American policy with it. Now, on the other hand, if Israel is the one that emerges victorious out of this conflict, and the U.S. emerges victorious as well, unlikely as it may be in the case of regime change, we've never seen regime change in the region without a ground invasion, without ground troops. And based on Donald Trump's comments yesterday, the U.S. doesn't seem to have the appetite for that sort of invasion. But if Israel does win and the Iranian regime and the system overall gets obliterated, then Israel emerges as the hegemon in the region. And Israel has proven over the past few years that it does not mind deploying force and an aerial power to achieve its political objectives in the region against its enemies, first and foremost. But if these conflicts continue to persist and Israel continues to seek out enemies in the region to neutralize, whether that's Iran today and perhaps Turkey tomorrow, it's shown that it's willing to deploy its enormous military power and force with the U.S. cheering in the background to carry out these objectives. And I don't think that the Gulf states would like to replace one hegemon with another. But for now, they're focused on the regional power that has been bombing their energy infrastructure, that has been bombing their real estate, that has been bombing civilians, and they're trying to sort of focus on minimizing the risk there, which is why all of the messaging that has been coming out of the Gulf has been, we are not involved in this war. We will defend ourselves if we have to, but we are not involved in this war. We're not giving over our airspace and bases over to the Americans to launch attacks on Iran. We want nothing to do with this. And obviously, they lobbied the U.S. Prior to the conflict, predicting that this is exactly what would happen if the U.S. was to bomb Iran, and we're seeing all of these scenarios play out right now. But what the end point is, obviously, nobody knows. Only Donald Trump knows. But we'll get to that eventually. But whichever scenario emerges out of this, whether it's an ascendant Iran that is very confident in its ability to strike at its neighbors with very little consequence, or if it's an Israel that's empowered by the absence of any regional rivals that can compete with it or that can push back against its objectives in the region, in either scenario, I don't think that the Gulf states will be happy with the outcome.
But Kareem, I wanted to ask you about a little further on this issue of where the Gulf states will land after the conflict. Everything that was happening before this indicated that, especially in the wake of the so-called Abraham Accords, that the Gulf states were trying to maneuver in a way to reconcile with Israel and to be able to continue to conduct business in the region. But I was struck especially by this open letter that one of the billionaire CEOs, the chairman of Al Haftour Group in the UAE, Khalaf Al Haftour, posted publicly this past week, where he a direct open letter to President Trump, and he wrote, I quote, "Who gave you the authority to drag our region into a war with Iran? And on what basis did you make this dangerous decision? Did you calculate the collateral damage before pulling the trigger? And did you consider that the first to suffer from this escalation will be the countries of the region itself?" So clearly, it seems that many people within the Gulf states are now questioning to what degree they expose themselves by being so close to the United States and allowing all of these bases to be put on their soil in terms of this now developing conflict. I'm wondering your thoughts on that.
Correct. Yes. I mean, the entire security arrangement in the Gulf was based on U.S. security architecture, that America was going to protect all of these Gulf countries from Iran in the event of a conflict. This scenario of missiles raining on Gulf cities has been envisioned, obviously, for a very long time, and they've been trying to create some sort of precautionary measures against it. The UAE in particular has been the target of the vast majority of Iran's missile capabilities outside of Israel. They've had to intercept so many drones and missiles using American provided systems, you know, THAAD and Patriot, as well as some locally developed systems in order to protect themselves. But the reality that they're realizing right now is that it's this American security architecture that is the cause of the instability, that is the cause of the war that has started and that they've lobbied so hard against. Khalaf Al Haftour, the businessman you're referring to, he's one of the icons of Dubai's real estate. He was one of the people who truly built the modern city of Dubai, one of its chief architects. Is incredibly close to the ruling families in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. And so you oftentimes expect that that these sorts of messages that come out of these prominent figures, public figures, tend to be proxies of what the governments and the people who actually wield power in these countries, the messages that they want to deliver to the U.S., but you know, without the directness of leader-to-leader statements. They obviously have to, you know, maintain a cordial relationship with the American president, no matter who it is, because that's what their security depends on. But ultimately, what they're realizing is that this security architecture itself has, in fact, brought this war upon them. Now, this does not say that Iran is not at fault. These Gulf countries feel immensely betrayed by what Iran has been doing, particularly, you know, countries like Qatar, which has had strong diplomatic relations with the Iranians. They've, in fact, you know, suffered isolation from other Gulf countries because of this this close relationship. Qatar has mediated the end of conflicts between Iran and the U.S. in the past. And during the previous war in June last year, Qatar got bombed while it was in the middle of negotiating a truce between the U.S. And Iran. And they continued to, they were very angry about it, obviously, but they continued to negotiate in good faith and they continued to try and bring peace to the region. But in the meantime, this security architecture is itself the cause of instability and the cause of danger for these Gulf states. They've tried very hard to push back against and to lobby against the U.S. involvement in this war, which nobody's entirely clear as to the rationale behind doing it in the first place. Over the past few years, the Abraham Accords suffered the major setback with the war on Gaza and with the destruction of the Palestinian people there. And that has made it incredibly unpalatable for a country like Saudi Arabia, which had a lot of interest in pursuing peace with Israel, to do so, given the immense public distaste and anger at the violence that was taking place in Gaza. And now,
Kareem, Kareem, I wanted to ask you one other thing. There's been a lot of a focus on, obviously, the shutdown of oil transport through the Strait of Hormuz. But I wanted to ask you about another aspect of this war that has not gotten much attention, is that the Strait of Hormuz is also the pathway through which an enormous portion of undersea cables for the communications and the internet worldwide between Europe and Asia pass through. Have you looked into or could you give us some thoughts on the danger posed in terms of worldwide communications if these cables are cut as a result of continuing conflict in that part of the world?
Yeah, so I mean, the Iranians have not indicated that was something that they're aiming to do, but obviously the issue is oftentimes not the immediate conflict itself. Iran has threatened to close the Strait of Hormuz before many times, and they've said that they would provide unlimited access to it to any country that evicts American and Israeli diplomats, which is obviously not going to happen. But the Iranians have threatened this many times in the past. The key component is whether there are any indications that the war is about to end, in which case these issues with oil prices and with potential communication challenges are going to disappear. As we saw yesterday, as soon as Trump indicated that the war may be a short excursion, as he described it, immediately the oil prices went down by a significant amount. The Dow regained some of its losses. And that's ultimately what seems to be moving the American president is this realization that the markets are responding to the war in a negative way. From the Iranian side, communication has been cut off for most people on the ground for a very long time. We've been trying through our Iranian correspondents who've been writing about the conflict and trying to talk to people on the ground, is that there's very limited communication, very limited coverage. It's very difficult to get a hold of people there and actually be able to tell the stories about the humanitarian suffering that they're going through. And at the same time, on the Gulf side, there's these constant attacks against energy infrastructure over there, including desalination plants, which have been critical to providing water and to fresh potable water to the local populations. And deliberate targeting of those facilities is in and of itself a war crime. So I think in terms of the Strait of Hormuz specifically, ultimately what's going to happen is that Iran, nor the Gulf states, nor the U.S., nor any of the countries in the region actually have an interest in maintaining closure for a very long time. And as soon as there are indications that the war is about to be over, this will not pose a problem, I think.
Very quickly, I wanted to ask you about this changing response to the killing of over 100 girls, 175 girls at the girls' school in southern Iran. Trump continuing to deny the U.S. carried out the strike last week. Most of the victims were children. Multiple investigations found direct video evidence contradicting Trump's claims. Video shows a U.S. Tomahawk missile striking the school, which is located near a naval base. I want to go to the news conference on Saturday, Trump and Defense Secretary Peter Hegseth held on the plane when they were asked by reporters aboard Air Force One about the girls' school strike.
Did the United States bomb a girls' elementary school in southern Iran on the first day of the war and kill 175 people?
In my opinion, based on what I've seen, that was done by Iran.
But the only side that targets civilians is Iran.
We think it was done by Iran. Because they're very inaccurate, as you know, with their munitions.
So Trump says it was Iran. Then he's asked again about the strike on the girls' school Monday.
Mr. President, you just suggested that Iran somehow got its hands on a tomahawk and bombed its own elementary school on the first day of the war. But you're the only person in your government saying this. Even your defense secretary wouldn't say that when he was asked, standing over your shoulder on your plane on Saturday. Why are you the only person saying this?
Because I just don't know enough about it. I think it's something that I was told is under investigation. But tomahawks are used by others, as you know. Numerous other nations have tomahawks. They buy them from us. But I will certainly, whatever the report shows, I'm willing to live with that report.
So, Kareem, New Lines magazine has published investigations into the strike on the girls' school, as well as a separate strike on Iranian emergency medical base in Shiraz that killed 20 people. In the last 2 minutes we have left, can you talk about both? And President Trump first saying it was Iran and now saying he can live with it if it wasn't.
Yeah, it's nonsense. I mean, we were among the first to investigate the initial strike on the school, and we showed that there was no evidence that Iran could have actually carried out the strike based on the available open source evidence. In the second strike, it was a clear case of bad targeting. They, instead of striking a Revolutionary Guard base that was about 200 meters away, and was quite large, they said struck an EMT center for first responders, and killed between 20 and 30 civilians and first responders. So this is a base that has existed and has been known publicly that it exists for the past 7 years. So it's clear there are problems with the targeting protocols with that process. And they're failing at protecting civilians. And this is not even to mention the strikes on the oil facilities that are now poisoning millions of people who live in Tehran. So it's clear that the Donald Trump is just trying to evade responsibility for this. And I think you had on your previous guest was talking about the failures leading up to the Iraq War. I was I grew up in the lead up to the Iraq War, and I remember it very well. And I'm going crazy watching everything that's going on right now. But it's really important for the media to also avoid the same failures of the Iraq War that the political class went through, which is to take the words of people like Donald Trump, who are clearly lying, at face value, and to just simply go with it and publish it as though it's it's just the other side of the story. We need to be constantly doing the sort of work that we've been doing by conducting open source investigations, by verifying these claims, and proving to the American people and to audiences around the world what is actually happening through these factual investigations. Just because Trump said it doesn't make it true.
Kareem Shaheen, Middle East editor for New Lines magazine, will link to your piece, The Gulf Fears Whoever Wins This War, and the other investigations of New Lines. Coming up, investigative journalist Antonia Yuhas, long documented wars for oil in 15 seconds.
What you do don't work for us, we'll turn you into dust. You savages are
wild. Chicano Batman in our Democracy Now studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Fear is mounting over the fate of worldwide energy markets and the global economy as oil prices on Monday soared to nearly $120 per barrel due to the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran before dropping. Iranian officials have said no oil would be allowed out of the Middle East until the bombardment ceased, with President Trump Monday threatening to hit Iran, quote, 20 times harder if it continues to block the passage of oil tankers in the Strait of Hormuz. In an interview with CBS yesterday, Trump said he's also considering taking over the strait. During a news conference earlier today, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth made similar threats, saying Iran would be attacked, quote, harder than ever, unquote, if it continues to disrupt the flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has retaliated by targeting energy infrastructure and U.S. military bases across Gulf nations. For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Antonia Yuhas, independent investigative journalist, regular Rolling Stone politics reporter, author of several books on fossil fuel industry, including The Bush Agenda and the Tyranny of Oil. Antonia, you have long reported on wars for oil. Talk about what's happening here. And it doesn't just involve the Gulf. It involves China. It involves oil in Russia and more.
Yeah, thank you, Amy. And thank you, Juan. It's good to be with you. I think what we're seeing is just one of the clearest depictions yet of the frailty of a global order that is grounded in fossil fuels. All sides in this war are using fossil fuels as a weapon of war. The Iranians are, of course, retaliating against the Israelis and the Americans by targeting energy infrastructure, by blocking the Strait of Hormuz, by saying we're going to drive up the price of oil and we're going to try to cut off supply to make this an unbearable war for you. the Israelis, backed by the Americans, have retaliated, directly targeting oil depots, directly targeting oil infrastructure. It was the bombing of the oil depots in Tehran, you know, with millions of residents, that has led to this sort of horrific apocalyptic reality of the bombing of the oil infrastructure, releasing plumes of toxic smoke, rain coming down through the smoke, and then carrying those toxins onto people, onto the environment, into soil, into water. I mean, I have been on this show many times talking about the harms and the toxicity of fossil fuels, reporting from Cancer Alley in Louisiana. Cancer Alley got its name because of the harms associated to people who live near fossil fuel production. This is, you know, that harm on a magnified scale. And as you said in the beginning, also targeting petrochemical complexes. These are, you know, fossil fuel-based facilities as well that turn fossil fuels into petrochemicals. These are massive facilities. And of course, the entire area around Iran and in Iran is an incredibly energy-rich environment that is being targeted for its fossil fuels, and fossil fuels are being used in retaliation. You know, after in the initial lead up to and the invasion of by Russia of Ukraine, Russia used fossil fuels as a weapon of war in exactly the same way that Iran is doing now. It restricted the flow of product, and it attempted to drive up price and reduce supply, and it has targeted fossil fuel infrastructure throughout Ukraine, and Ukraine has actually done its best to try and target fossil fuel infrastructure in Russia. But in response to that invasion, Ukrainians initially put out a call that the world actually picked up, which was, we need to end our reliance on fossil fuels because fossil fuels are fueling the Russians' ability to wage war and Russians' ability to use fossil fuels as a weapon. And around the world, we actually saw a response to that. We saw policies put in place to try and get off of fossil fuels. Trump aligned with Russia to immediately reverse that progress and those policies, and has instead launched the United States into at least two, but we could keep counting, wars or excursions, in his words, that are about and grounded in and accelerate the continued reliance on fossil fuels. We have Venezuela. We obviously have also Iran and the rest of the Middle East. And the implications are, you know, extreme. Of course, you have the immediate human health harms, security harms in Iran, throughout the Middle East, from the war, from the targeting, of course, of the infrastructure. You also have the ongoing harms of what it means to have that fossil fuel pollution continue to impact soil and water and the health of people. And then, of course, our continued deep dependence on fossil fuels.
Antonia, you mentioned these two military attacks all occurring this year on Venezuela with the largest proven oil reserves in the world, and on Iran now with the third largest reserves in the world. So is it your sense that the Trump administration is essentially now becoming not only an empire, but an empire seeking to control a world oil supplies?
You know, I think that the two wars, military uses of the military, are not identical. Of course, Iran has long been a target of obviously the Israelis and of the Americans, and sometimes for the same reasons and sometimes for different reasons, and sometimes for reasons that support each other and sometimes they don't necessarily support each other. But the source of Iran's power is certainly its fossil fuels and its control of fossil fuels. And if you want to take those fossil fuels, if you're U.S. oil companies, that's a goal.
Ten seconds, Antonia.
But also, if you want to deflate Iran's power going after its fossil fuels, is one of the key ways to do that. And that's clearly an agenda that's being advanced by this administration.
Antonia, we're going to do part two of this discussion, put online at democracynow.org. Antonia Yuhas, independent investigative journalist, regular Rolling Stone politics reporter, will continue after the broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Hi, this is Sukyun Lee, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby.
Standing up against racism is an ongoing battle. How will you help?
Everyone should be treated equally, and the legal system should work for the people, not against them. Every day, our network of supporters, lawyers, and educators from across the country continue to fight against injustice and oppression, both in and outside of the courtroom and at all levels of government.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.